Hi, this is Dan Kilbride, and I am the host of New Books in American Studies. And every week or so, that means we interview an author on the field of, in this case, usually history, but also American public health, architecture, art, and so on. Today, I am very excited to be joined by Erskine Clark. We're going to be talking about his book, By the Rivers of Water, which is about American missionaries in Africa in the first half of the 19th century, which has just been published by Basic Books. Erskine Clark is Professor Emeritus of American Religious History at Columbia Theological Seminary. He is also the author of A Dwelling Place, a Plantation Epic, which was published by Yale University Press in 2005, and won a whole bunch of awards, most importantly, the Bancroft Prize, which is the big dog in American history. And he's also the publisher of a number of other books, specifically on American and Southern religious history. Professor Clark, welcome to New Books in American Studies.
Thank you. Delighted to be in conversation with you.
What can you tell us? What do we need to know about you, and specifically, what brought you to this book?
Well, I think the main thing that you need to know about me is what you've said, that I'm Professor Emeritus of American Religious History at Columbia Theological Seminary in Atlanta. And the primary focus of my scholarly interest has been the American South, particularly the antebellum period, and the role of religious belief, religious life in the American South during that period, especially in relationship to slavery. So I have tried to understand the complex relationship between religious belief and the social and cultural context in which Southerners, both white and black, lived out their lives during this period.
And how did you come across John Layton Wilson and Jane Bayard Wilson?
Yep. Well, I grew up in South Carolina, which is John Layton Wilson's, it was his home state. Mm-hmm. And he was known there among people who remembered him. And there are a lot of people over several generations who have carried his name because of the respect that people had for him. And so I knew about him for a long time, and I was particularly intrigued by the fact that he and his wife freed their slaves. They had inherited a number of slaves, and the fact that they freed them as part of this commitment to going to West Africa as missionaries. And that stood in such a sharp contrast to most of the other people that I had studied who tried other ways to deal with the question of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So I was intrigued by that, and the more I learned about him, and learned about her with her own important role in this this decision making about freeing slaves and about mm-hmm. life and work in West Africa, the more intrigued I became.
The title of your book, By the Rivers of Water, comes from Psalm 1, and the passage is, "And he shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that bringeth forth fruit in his season." I'm just intrigued. Why did you choose that passage for your title?
Well, choosing a title for a book is not always very easy. At least it's not been in my experience. And so I was in a conversation with publisher about this, and we were looking at a variety of possibilities. And because rivers played such an important part in the lives of both this couple and also of the slaves whose lives are followed, and also once they arrived in West Africa, especially in Gabon, the importance of rivers there. So
mm-hmm.
There was a way in which their lives were lived out by these rivers of water, from the Savannah River to the Black River in South Carolina, to these West African rivers.
Why don't you provide, just so our listeners can have some kind of context, just give us some background about Leighton, as he was known, I take it, and Jane Bayard Wilson. What was their family and personal backgrounds, and specifically, what made them want to be missionaries, and especially missionaries in Africa?
Right. Well, both of them came from affluent families, white southern families, and she came from a particularly affluent family that had deep roots as well in the north, especially in Pennsylvania, but also in New Jersey and New York, and Delaware, too, for that matter. She grew up in Savannah. Her father was a physician there. Her mother was the daughter of a Revolutionary War general, a lieutenant general, Major Lieutenant General Lachlan McIntosh. And so she grew up the first part of her life in Savannah, going back and forth between Savannah and some family plantations south of Savannah, down what is today the Intercoastal Waterway.
Mm-hmm.
And her parents died when she was young, and she and her sister went to live with their uncle in Philadelphia, a very wealthy Philadelphia banker. And so they spent some years in Philadelphia in the home of this banker, and in the context of a very traditional Presbyterian, Philadelphia Presbyterians, and with their strong connections with Princeton, that whole stretch of the middle states.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Leighton Wilson grew up in a family that traced its ancestry back to the arrival in Charleston, South Carolina, in the 1730s, of a group of Scottish and Scotch-Irish immigrants who were given land by the colonial government up the Black River, which is called Black because of the stain of that the cypress trees, the way the cypress trees stained the river. And each generation of these settlers moved a little further up the river. So by the time Leighton Wilson was born and was growing up, settlements had become increasingly prosperous, and during his youth, with the spread of cotton inland and the invention of the cotton gin that allowed for the short staple cotton to be grown in profitable ways, these farms were turning into very profitable plantations as they drew on the labors and sorrows of increasingly large numbers of black slaves who were first brought in from Charleston. So he grew up in a very tight family, surrounded by many aunts and uncles and cousins, and of these Scottish, Scotch-Irish Presbyterians there on this Black River. He grew up with a slave settlement right there below the plantation house where he lived, and was surrounded by increasing numbers of black slaves who did the hard labor of a plantation.
Mm-hmm. You know, one question that I kept asking myself as I read this book was, why would anybody in their right minds in this era want to be a missionary in Africa?
Yeah.
And I, specifically, this poor guy, or I should say this guy, the poor wives of this guy named William Walker.
Yes.
You know, going to Africa was just a slight exaggeration to call it almost a death sentence.
Yes.
In addition to the sheer distance of that these people are going to be from home, what made these very privileged, if devout people like the Wilsons, like William Walker and his wives, none of whom survived very long in Africa.
Yes.
What made them, what impelled them?
Yes.
To become missionaries in Africa?
Right. Well, that's an important question. I think what you've just described, it needs to be said that what was particularly deadly for them was malaria. And they were especially, whites were especially susceptible to malaria. Africans and people of African descent have developed over the millennia, really, some resistance to malaria, but whites have, because of long exposure. And the sickle cell is a result of that. But whites were particularly vulnerable, so you're right. To go to Africa did seem suicidal, and that is what many people said to the Wilsons and
right.
the others. Why are you doing this? As any action like this, I think you are able to identify mixed motives. That is, I don't mean mixed motives in a negative way, but
right.
motives
mm-hmm.
that spring from different sources. The most obvious and powerful source was the Second Great Awakening, this huge revival that swept across the country during the early decades of the 19th century, and the kind of evangelical commitments that it stirred. And as a part of that, there was a really for the first time a concerted Protestant missionary effort. Roman Catholics had been involved in missionary effort for long time, but for a variety
right.
of reasons, Protestants had not been, and there had been some, but not much. This great evangelical awakening that was also in Great Britain and on the continent, the European continent, with Pietism and other religious movements. So it was transatlantic religious revival. This revival stirred in people a sense of responsibility for evangelization, and the mission movement itself, as I said, emerged out of that. And they simply, the Wilsons and the other missionaries that went out, felt a deep sense of calling, vocation to bring a Christian message to people who did not know it. They thought that the Christian message was a message that all people needed to have available to them to be able to hear. And they thought that such a message was vital, not only for their eternal salvation, which obviously they thought, so mm-hmm. also for their well-being in this world. So it had that strong kind of evangelical commitment that was
right.
part of it. Now, for the Wilsons, one of the very interesting things was that they felt a special responsibility for Africa because of what had been done to Africans with the international slave trade.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that white Southerners were the primary ones in the U.S. who had benefited from that. And so as white Southerners, there was a sense of obligation to Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a part of their going.
Right. The Wilsons were traveling, and other missionaries, at a time when Americans knew comparatively little about Africa. You know, and one thing the Wilsons do in their periodic trips back to the States is try to inform Americans, including their own families and social circles, about Africa, and they end up challenging many assumptions about Africa. What did Americans at this time think that they knew about Africa?
Well, I would say Americans and Europeans generally knew very little about Africa, and the little that they knew was cast primarily in terms of stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
So it was dark Africa. It was a place of savages. It was a dangerous place. It was also a place of wealth that could be extracted in a variety of ways, but most specifically in terms of people.
Mm-hmm.
That is by the international slave trade. Now, the international slave trade had been made illegal in the U.S. and in by Great Britain in 1808. So slaves could no longer be legally brought into the U.S. After 1808, there were a few mm-hmm. slave ships that came in, but secretly, say, to the islands off of the coast of Georgia. But by and large, the massive importation of slaves into the South was had been ended. So Americans' image, the image of whites, just let me put it that way, of Africa was again mixed. It was a dark continent. It was also exotic.
Mm-hmm.
That is, it was strange and different, and therefore intriguing. People were quite intrigued by what was in Africa, especially what was beyond the coastline.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What lay on the other side of the mountains of the moon, for example, this string of mountains that whites mm-hmm. thought extended down the coast. So there was that sense of intrigue. But I think most pressing and important for this story, and really for the story, the long story of whites' images of Africa, was that Africans were not only savages, but increasingly in the 19th century, they were regarded, with the rise of scientific racism, they were regarded as really lesser people, people with less intelligence, so less capabilities of civilized life and so on. So there was resistance to the mission movement
mm-hmm.
because some said, well, why are you going to Africa when Africans can't really become Christians? I mean,
mm-hmm.
they don't have the capacity. That was a part of this deep, deep racism that was there. And so a big part of what the Wilsons did in their mission work and relationship, excuse me, in their relationship to the American scene was to write and say, hey, no, this is not right. There's mm-hmm. one particular part of that where they describe how quickly African children could learn English and the other things that they were teaching in the schools, from math to geography. They even had a telescope where they were looking at the stars and the moon and so on. And back, there was one letter that was particularly important, I thought, that was written to this group of planters, very wealthy planters immediately south of Charleston
mm-hmm.
on Johns Island. And they said, we know that there's this general idea that Africans are stupid, but you would not think so if you could come to this school and see how smart these children are and how quickly they have mastered another language, how quickly they've become bilingual, mm-hmm. really. And so they go on like that. So there are a variety of ways in which they try to tell the story of Africa by saying these people that we are encountering are fully human and fully capable, as whites are and other races are.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most important ways that Leighton Wilson did that was a book that he published in 1856 called Western Africa. And in that book, it's quite a sophisticated book, really. In that book, he starts off by saying that Africans are different kind of Africans. They're not all just alike, mm-hmm. like Europeans. Mm-hmm. They're not the Italians are not just like the Swedes and so on. The Poles are not like the Spanish. And so he distinguishes between different groups, and he talks about language. He's quite a linguist himself.
Yes, he is.
Very, very careful linguist. But one of the things is he talks and goes into great detail about the great civilizations of West Africa and what they had accomplished. Now, he's horrified by some aspects of West Africa.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
But he also is he's also deeply impressed by the richness of the culture and by the people that he is encountering, and he tries to convey that in his writings.
Mm-hmm. You know, it did remind me of I've been doing some work on David Livingstone, and the great Scottish explorer, and Leighton's perspective on Africans reminded me very strongly of Livingstone's sympathy and respect for African cultures, even though he felt that Christianization would entail the destruction of those cultures, which he was resigned to for the sake of salvation. But he did deeply respect African peoples. Do you have the impression that the Wilsons' advocacy on behalf of Africans in the United States to these planters, and also the letters they wrote and were published in the missionary magazines, did they make a difference in Americans' perceptions of Africa and Africans, or did it mostly just?
Yeah. I don't. I wouldn't want certainly to exaggerate in any way the impact of that, because the stereotypes not only lingered, but as the 19th century went on and there was this growing, as I said, scientific racism,
mm-hmm.
Based increasingly on Darwin and some distortions, really, of Darwin, but nevertheless, like the survival of the fittest and so on. This very harsh kind of scientific racism gained ground as the 19th century proceeded, and we know the very bitter results of it with the rise of the Nazis in Germany.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, having said that, it's true that among some, it made a difference. This earlier book of mine that you mentioned, Dwelling Place, A Plantation Epic, Wilson's letters were published in religious journals. And one of the mm-hmm. things that the plantation owners in this particular part of Georgia did was they read those letters on Sunday afternoon to slaves who were gathered for, it was like a kind of Sunday school time. And by actually reading those letters, it's a very interesting, I think, dynamic that's involved in there. By actually reading those letters, it at least had the potential not only of changing the way in which whites viewed Africans, but strengthening memories, oral memories of slaves about about Africa, and their hearing of these students who were so smart and who were being taught to read, and they couldn't be taught to read.
Yeah,
the slaves,
that's right.
These American slaves couldn't be taught to read. Or hearing about a particularly brilliant Mpongwe trader, this man Toko, that the Wilsons admired so much down in Gabon. It helped to say, you know, that being black doesn't mean necessarily being a slave. There are other possibilities.
The
possibility of freedom. So, I say I don't want to exaggerate the impact of these letters.
Sure.
How widely they were read. I certainly don't want to exaggerate that. But nevertheless, I do think at different places and the different circumstance and in different kinds of circumstances, they did have an impact on some whites and on the slaves who also were able to hear those letters.
Yeah. The Wilsons and other missionaries were greeted very warmly by Africans. The two groups that they encountered at two different places. Is it the Gribo? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, Gribo. Mm-hmm.
Gribo and the Mokambwe greeted them quite warmly. But interestingly, the people who did not greet the missionaries warmly were the colonizationists, American settlers in Africa who are not missionaries. And I wondered if you could, first of all, talk about the Africans. Why did Africans, these peoples, greet the Wilsons and other missionaries so warmly?
Well, again, I would say there were mixed reasons for that. One reason was that in the particular African cultures where the Wilsons were located, both among the Gribo and the Mpongwe, there was a tradition of hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
So that played a role. They also knew that whites came to their shores in large ships with lots of stuff and stuff that they wanted, that Africans wanted. And
right.
So they in fact had been for generations engaged in trade with merchants who would bring a wide variety of products from not only from the West, incidentally, but also, say, from India,
right?
Like cottons and cloth. They were particularly interested in certain kinds of Indian textiles that were. It's part of this really global economy that was already going on.
Yeah.
So there was the cultural thing of hospitality. There was economic aspect of the missionaries being here will encourage trade and so on. There was also, I think, wonderment about what is it about whites that has allowed them to have all this stuff on these ships?
Right.
And to have these big ships, what is it about white culture that has been able to produce all of these different goods and to build these big ships? So there was interest in what was behind, to say it most simply, white power.
Mm-hmm.
And white affluence that could be seen with these ships that came sailing up and down the coast. So one of the things that they identified very quickly was the importance of literacy and learning to read and write.
Mm-hmm.
So Both among the Grebo and among the Mapungwe, there was an eagerness to have their children educated in the missionary schools. And there was the hope that by learning to read and write, some of the power, some of the affluence that they saw that whites had, that they could begin to acquire themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And with that was, among some at any rate, a curiosity about a wider and what would to them was exotic world, the world
right.
of Europe
mm-hmm.
and America in particular. So all of those things came together that made the mission schools very, very popular among the people at Cape Palmas, where the Grebo were, and then mm-hmm. the Gabon Estuary. I think one of the really interesting things about this is they were not particularly interested in having their, in fact, they resisted having their... At least some of them began to be converted.
I'm sorry, Professor Clark. There was some chop in the connection there, just for about the last 10 seconds.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure it came through. Can you just repeat what you were just saying about the Grebo?
Well, I was saying that they, the Grebo, were interested in having their children educated.
Yeah,
they were not particularly, and most of them were not particularly interested. In fact, resisted having their children converted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, but some of the children, in fact, were converted, and a few and adults began to be converted too. Not in the number
yeah.
that the children were, but adults were as well. A part of what I think is really intriguing about this at a lot of different levels, but one is the sense that in order to move into the Western world or to be modern, to utilize perhaps a simpler way of describing it, they knew they had to become acculturated in some way
mm-hmm.
to Western
mm-hmm.
ways. And Western and particularly Western literacy and the sciences of the West, and yet they wanted to keep many of them wanted to keep the traditions of their people,
mm-hmm.
and so there's this deep tension that is there between. Wanting to be westernized, as it were, and at the same time not wanting to give up the traditions of their, and that is a huge tension that you see.
Yes.
That you see there, and it's really a worldwide phenomenon, and it plays out in different, including the U.S. I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's played out in different ways. So that's certainly an important part. The other thing is that Africans, and I'll talk about the Grebo, among other things, they had the capacity to be skeptical, just like whites had the capacity to be skeptical about their own religious traditions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so this one man who was the brother of the king at King Freeman at Cape Palmas, Maury Ma, who had the English name Davis, and he was a particularly brilliant person, spoke a number of languages and so on, and was highly respected within the Grebo community. He becomes a Christian. It's a long process.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah, but he becomes a Christian. And what's interesting about that, and I think this is really one of the important things of understanding what's happened to Africa in the 20th century is that he didn't become a Georgia Christian or a South Carolina Christian.
Yeah.
He became a Grave Oak Christian. That is, he took with him into his Christianity those voices from his that he had from his earliest childhood,
mm-hmm.
Grebo, the very language itself, the Grebo language itself. He took that with him into Christianity. He also took four wives, which was
right.
One of the tensions, but the missionaries worked that out. They said, you know, that he was not to have any other wives, but those four, and if you broke up a family like that, it would be a terrible thing, and so on.
Right.
So, but he really becomes a Grave Oak Christian, and I think that is very, very important to acknowledge. He was the translator, actually, and teacher of John Layton Wilson when Wilson arrived. He's the one
yeah.
who taught Wilson not only the Grebo language, but also was one who helped Wilson to interpret what Wilson was observing around him in this culture. What does it mean? What does this funeral, Grebo funeral, mean? What's going on there? Those kinds of cultural questions. William Davis was the primary interpreter
yeah.
for Wilson. So when Wilson writes the first, he develops the first alphabet for the Grebo that fits with the Grebo language, and he writes first grammar and book and dictionary and so on with the Grebo. When he comes to the task of translating in the New Testament, sections from the New Testament, he has to depend on a Grebo to help him with that.
Right.
Say the word God.
Yeah.
What Grebo word can he use if he is translating, say, the Gospel of John?
Right, exactly, yes.
What Grebo word can he use? And he has to be in conversation with Grebo about that. And with it's a very tricky thing.
Yep.
Can you use the name of a Grebo god? Or do you? Is there something else that you can, that some other word that you can use? Or what does it mean to talk about light and darkness, as the Gospel
yeah.
of John talks about light and darkness? Well, what does that mean? What does light mean to the Grebo, and what does this mean? So the point I want to make is two points, really, about this translation. The first point is that it was a joint effort. It was that Wilson and the other missionaries who came later and who were working in they didn't just translate this on their own. They
mm-hmm.
had to have interpreters.
Yes.
Who were directing and guiding them, that is, native speakers, who were deeply a part of that culture, who were guiding them and
mm-hmm.
making decisions about, well, what Grebo word do we use for God, or for light, or for darkness? The second thing is, once he had translated these different books of the Gospels in particular, and also the book of Acts. They were quite interested in the book of Acts for a variety
mm-hmm.
of reasons, with a lot of healing stories and other stories that were quite interesting for the Grebo. But once they translated that, the missionaries, and they printed them, and there was this African-American printer who was a part of the mission there, B.V.R. James, who was this very skilled printer, and he printed just thousands of pages of text. And when he printed the Grebo, the parts of the Grebo New Testament, the missionaries no longer had control over that, because the Grebo could take
mm-hmm.
and read it themselves and interpret it themselves about, well, what is the what is Christianity about? And if the missionary mm-hmm. said one thing, the Grey Book would say, well, it says here this, and I don't think you're right, because it says in the Gospel of John, thus and so. So Christianity, as it develops in Africa, really, and it's this amazing development that takes place there in the 20th century. The growth of Christianity in Africa has been really one of the most amazing things in the Christianity. From something like 9 million Christians mm-hmm. below the Sahara at the beginning of the 20th century to it's approaching 600 million now.
Oh, my.
It's just phenomenal. And most of that evangelization has been done, not by the missionaries, but by
yes.
Africans themselves.
And that was their intention, right? They saw themselves as sort of a vanguard, but they envisioned educating Africans who would then evangelize Africa.
Right.
Right, yeah.
That was the early mission vision that they would evangelize Africans, and that there would be an African church run by Africans and supported by Africans and so on. Now, it is true that later missionaries, that especially, again, thinking of this growing scientific racism and the way in which that spread throughout the culture, later missionaries were much more paternalistic. And so you have these images in the early part of the 20th century. I mean, these not images, these stories of a very patronizing missionaries who are going to say, well, we know that Africans can't really handle the finances of this, so we have to continue to handle the finances.
Mm.
Or we know that Africans really are not going to be able to be the primary interpreters of the Gospel of John. We have to continue to interpret for them. And the Africans are going to resist that. And so that's a big part of the story, is the way African Christians claim their own independence from the missionaries. And it's changed a good bit in recent decades, where they are this missionaries are much more likely to be in a cooperative and invited by the churches in these different African countries. But all of that goes back to the fact that, one, the translations were joint efforts of missionaries and Africans themselves, and two, once these primary documents, these primary books of Christian faith were translated, then the Africans claimed them for themselves. It's now mm-hmm. in Gribo. A Gribo.
Right.
It's now in my language, and I can read it and interpret it myself.
Yeah. The other book that you mentioned Africans were particularly drawn to besides Acts was Matthew, correct? What was it about the Gospel of Matthew that they found so meaningful?
I think again, the whole question about healing was a very important question for them. It's an important question for people all over the world, but they saw these stories of healing and these miraculous stories mm-hmm. of healing, and that was very powerful for them. They also saw stories about demons being cast out,
mm-hmm.
and so there was a lot that resonated with traditional aspects of African culture,
right.
and because of that, they found these books intriguing. And that was a question that the missionaries had to ask themselves. Where do you start? If you're going to translate, if you're just learning a new language and you're committed to this mission effort, and you've got the Bible with all of the different books in the Bible, where do you start? Do you start with Genesis?
Mm-hmm.
Do you start with Job? Or do you start with the Psalms? Or do you start with Matthew or Acts or Gospel of John, or one of the epistles of Paul? So those were questions that had to be asked.
Right.
And it's been an ongoing kind of question even as translation goes on into different languages today.
You know, one of the relationships that was that were fraught with a lot of tension in this book are the relationships between missionaries and settlers, especially a guy named John Russworm, who you spend a very interesting figure who you spend a lot of time discussing, and also between the settlers and the native Africans.
Yes.
Why were there, what made the settlers in particular different from the missionaries? And why was there so much antagonism between settlers and Africans?
Well, let me say first who the settlers were. The settlers were African Americans who were either free people, that is, came from families that had been freed earlier, or they were slaves, former slaves, who had been freed in a return to Africa.
Right.
And there was a movement that was under the broad umbrella of the American Colonization Society that was run by whites that helped to establish Monrovia in what is today Liberia. And that became other colonies began to come in and be established by freed slaves and free people of African Americans. And there was great debate within the African American community about the whole colonization movement. Africa was viewed by many as Mother Africa, and a place where they could be free people away from the racism of whites, away from the oppression of slavery. And so there was that attraction on hand. Other African Americans said, colonization is primarily a white project to use what the whites themselves said, to whiten America.
Mm-hmm.
They said the racism was so powerful that they said there is no place in an American republic for black people. Therefore, it is necessary for us to do everything that we can to rid America of blacks. And the way we do that is by establishing a colony in West Africa that became Liberia. So that was the deep tensions there. On the one hand, you have the longing of an oppressed people for a home and a place that is free from the racism and oppression that existed for them and the U.S. On the other hand, you have whites who are wanting to promote colonization precisely because of their racism and their fear of free, the great fear of free blacks.
Yeah.
And so most African Americans opposed during the antebellum period opposed strongly the colonization movement, but there were some who wanted to return to Mother Africa and who did in Monrovia, and then this group that I'm focused on at Cape Palmas. Now, they thought of themselves as going to Mother Africa, but when they arrived, one of the interesting things that happened, and really very, not just ironic, but deeply revealing of the character of the oppression that they had endured in the U.S., one of the things that happened was that rather than identifying themselves as Africans, they were very keen to identify themselves as Americans.
Yeah, that's right.
and to say, we, in fact, are different from these savages who live around us. We know how to wear clothes properly, and we know how to farm properly and so on, in spite of the fact that the Gbo were great farmers, by the way, huge rice fields. And but anyway, there was this sense of difference between them. And so wars broke out almost immediately between the settlers and the surrounding, both in Monrovia and in time also down at Cape Palmas, between the settlers and the Africans. Part of it had to do with different understanding of land and land ownership. The African Americans had understanding of land ownership like we have here. You buy a piece of property and it's yours, and you do with it is within certain limits what you want to do with it, and you can't have it just taken from you. The Africans had a much more communal understanding of land, and so they didn't think of themselves as giving land to the African American settlers in the contract, but as they having the right to farm it for a while, and then they certainly didn't want the African Americans intruding onto traditional lands of the Gbo. So there was great tension there. In that tension, the Wilsons very much took the side of the Africans and came to believe their own, the people that their own slaves that they freed, they had helped them to come to actually to Cape Palmas and to get settled and so on. But they came to believe that was a great mistake, and they wished that they had rather encouraged them to go to the north, northern states, and to live as free people there. One of the things that was happening globally was that, and had been happening, was that European imperialism was happening in the in these years of the 19th century in a very aggressive way, and both in, say, in South Africa and in Australia and New Zealand, other places. White settlers were intruding and taking the land of the indigenous people. And what the Wilsons came to see, at least their perspective, was that the black settlers were no different from the white settlers in Africa or wherever else, and that they were acting in an imperialistic fashion. In fact, they compared what was happening to the Gbo with the African American colonists to what was happening with the Cherokee back at home, in Georgia, with the white settlers taking Cherokee land, because the settlers were interested in expanding and going into this new land that the Gbo had, and so that was the result of a lot of attention. Now the governor at Cape Palmas at what was called Maryland in Liberia, because it was by the Maryland Colonization Society, was this remarkable African-American named John Rusewarm, one of the first African-Americans. Some people think he was the first African-American to graduate from college. He had been a founder of the first African-American newspaper in the country in New York. And he was a brilliant man and a man deeply committed to a homeland for African Americans and in West Africa. And he more publicly, at least, than anyone else, the Palmas and the on the among the colonists, was sympathetic to the Gbo. And he and King Freeman did much to negotiate the differences between them. He resented, he was a very proud man, and he resented greatly when arriving and finding right out on the edge of the colony, this mission station with this white missionary from South Carolina.
Yeah.
And it just, you can just imagine how offensive that must have been to him. And while he and Wilson cooperated in a number of ways, the Wilsons were very popular with the Gray Boat, and so played an important role when there were serious threats of war, played an important role in peacemaking. So Roosworm and Wilson cooperated, but they were hostile to each other. And Wilson's own racism emerges at this point. And this is one of the real hard things about this story, I think. And that is, in spite of all of his efforts to escape the racism of his youth, the way it would pop up and in some ways catch him by surprise, but it was there. It was rumbling around these deep assumptions from his childhood about whites and blacks. In spite of what he would say about the brilliance of this scholar, that's African scholar, or the richness of African cultures and all, it would come out. And it came out with Roosworm because he thought that Roosworm, in fact, was incompetent as a governor of the colony.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the colony was from American history experience of colonists coming in, it's tough. I mean, to be a colonist, go in. I mean, it's not an easy task, and it takes certain kinds of skills. And Roosworm himself said to the Colonization Society back in Baltimore, to the whites, he said, you know, you just can't send anybody out here and expect them to be able to manage on what is basically a frontier. And so he complained bitterly about some of the colonists himself. But nevertheless, you see this tension emerging between Wilson and the governor, and the Wilsons decide finally that they cannot, that the antagonism between the Gray Bow and the colonists, that antagonism is so intense that they can't keep the mission there. And so they move to Gabon. They move way down the coast to Gabon and establish a mission there. Well, incidentally, they oppose another kind of imperialism.
The French.
The French imperialists. The French come in. The French end up bombarding the mission station with their naval guns because they think the missionaries are taking the side of the indigenous people, which they were.
Which they were.
That's another part of the story.
Right. Yeah, that was it's very sad, and especially, you know, you mentioned William Davis before, but in this part of the book, there's a major figure named Toko, who is a very tragic figure, but is very, very sympathetic, and somebody who the Wilsons obviously deeply respect. We've almost occupied an hour, but I did want to give you the opportunity to just tell us. Interestingly, you know, after about 20 years in 1853, the Wilsons returned to the United States once and for all. And of course, the Civil War is on the horizon. And it's sort of surprisingly for their views about slavery and the slave trade, the Wilsons, or especially Layton, chooses to return to the South and to support the Confederacy. How do you explain that?
Yeah. Well, they go to New York, and he's head of the board of foreign missions for the Presbyterian Church there, one of the heads, and he's quite a youthist, really, up until late. Towards the approach of the Civil War, really, there are a variety of things. It is a great I think it's one of the really tragic parts of the story.
Mm-hmm.
He views the election of Lincoln as the beginning of an aggressive Northern imperialism against the South, against his homeland, and he's in this long argument with this close friend and cousin of his wife's, Charles Hodge, who's a professor at Princeton Theological Seminary and a very influential man there. And Hodge, of course, doesn't see it that way at all. But Wilson is agonizes about what to do. And finally, he decides he simply cannot stay in the North while his family at home and his homeland mm-hmm. Is what he regards as under attack from this aggressive Northern imperialistic regime that is now in control of Washington. And so he turns his face towards home, and he goes back to South Carolina and back to the place where he grew up, and he spends basically the rest of his life. He spends some time later after the war in Baltimore, but basically mm-hmm. life is there. And the troubling things about this are the way in which, just like for William Davis, the Grabo, and Toko, the Mapungwe, the way these old voices, these old traditions call from the depths of one's being and shape present decision.
Mm.
And what I think happened with Wilson was these old voices that from his childhood and growing up, and people that he loved and cared about deeply, his family, that were just so powerful that that in spite of his emancipating his slaves, in spite of his fighting and we've not talked about this, but when he was in West Africa, he was a vigorous opponent of the international slave trade.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In spite of that, in spite of what he wrote about challenge stereotypes of Africans, in spite of all of that, these old voices called him home.
Yeah.
And so the whole question of human freedom, not just the harsh question of slavery, but the question of a person's ability to transcend, to find some transcendence from and freedom from the contingencies of one's life. The fact that he was born in South Carolina, that he was mm-hmm. raised by this,
mm-hmm.
just the difficulty of transcending that. That is a very troubling part of this story. And it's a yeah. troubling part of the whole story of the American South, of people of goodwill. Whites, I'm talking about now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's not black Southerners. People of goodwill who are unable to escape the bondage of their whiteness and of their traditions that they loved.
Yeah. Well, as you suggested a second ago, we have left a lot of topics on the cutting room floor just for the lack of time to discuss them. I do want to thank you very much for talking with me today. It is a By the Rivers of Water is not only a fascinating book, it is a model, I think, for historical writing, which, in my opinion, I'll just editorialize here for a second, is becoming a lost art. Historians used to write well, not so much anymore, but I think this book is a wonderful read. So I want to thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you, and thank you for those words. They're very encouraging, and for the chance to be in conversation with you today.
Well, once again, my name is Dan Kilbride. I'm the host of New Books in American Studies. We've been speaking with Erskine Clark about his brand new book, By the Rivers of Water, A 19th Century Atlantic Odyssey. And on your screen, you will see a link to this book. It'll take you right to Amazon.com. I strongly, strongly recommend buying this book. So once again, this is Dan Kilbride, and we'll see you next time.